We're all over the place at any given time throughout the year.
Customs officials find heroin in unlikely places. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new Chukchi environmental impact statement doesn't sit well with environmentalists.
Their evaluation went in with the idea that we have to affirm this lease sale and now let's justify it. That is disturbing to me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
U.S. Customs officials have seized more than $1.2 million worth of heroin in three different shipments through Anchorage's FedEx facility. The drugs were discovered in April and this month. On April 22nd, customs officers searched a shipment of women's purses from Malaysia, which were found to contain 432 grams of heroin sewn into the liners. On April 26th, almost 2 kilograms of heroin were found in a package of baby wipes, and on May 10th, 830 grams were hidden in picture frames sent from Thailand. All the seizures add up to 6 pounds. The incidents are under investigation, according to Jerry McGee, Chief Customs and Border Protection Officer in Anchorage.
We encountered narcotics by our officers intercepting those, and heroin is one of the narcotics that we see on a fairly regular basis.
McGee can't say where the packages were destined because of the ongoing investigation. He says 6 pounds of heroin is considered a lot. McGee says Anchorage cargo facilities pose a challenge to customs officers.
It's a hub facility where the cargo facility where this heroin was intercepted by our officers. We also intercept IPR and intellectual property rights stuff, counterfeit merchandise, fraudulent documents. We intercept counterfeit prescription medicine. So it's not just narcotics that we intercept. It's the whole gauntlet of things that are entering the United States.
There are more than 100 Customs and Border Protection officers statewide, with about half of them stationed in Anchorage. McGee says cruise ship season is a busy time for his officers, with ships entering various ports across the state.
We're all over the place at any given time throughout the year.
McGee says they've even got customs inspectors at Poker Creek on the top of the World Highway. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, or BOMRA, released today a draft supplemental environmental impact statement for the Chukchi Sea lease sale 193. The draft was developed after environmental and native organizations sued over the 2008 sale, saying important cumulative impacts from drilling were not considered in the first EIS. Environmental groups are decrying today's release, saying it doesn't address information that was deemed missing in the first document. Carol Hawley is the Alaska Program Co-Director for Pacific Environment, one of the original plaintiffs in the lawsuit against BOMRA. She says nothing has really changed.
The worst thing that came out of this document for me is that despite BOMRA's obligation to balance development with environmental protection and the protection of the peoples of the North Slope, including the native village of Point Hope, they still have come out and favored development. And it seems that this draft environmental impact statement went in with the idea that we have to affirm this lease sale and now let's justify it. That is disturbing to me.
Hawley says the U.S. Geological Survey has just concluded a report on the missing information in the Arctic. She says BOMRA's release of the new draft EIS before reviewing the USGS study is unfortunate. She says any activity in the Chukchi will not only impact marine life, it will greatly impact the subsistence hunters in the Arctic who depend on them.
What I'm seeing with this, in conjunction with President Obama's announcement last Saturday that we're going to streamline the process for Arctic leasing and opening up the NPRA, is really a caving into the political pressures from our own senators and congressmen and from the oil companies.
BOMRA officials refused comment today, but contend the revised draft addresses the concerns raised by Judge Ralph Beislein, the federal judge who handled the lawsuit brought by the Native Village of Point Hope, Pacific Environment, and others. Beislein gave BOMRA until October 3rd to finalize their decision, but he wants a progress report by June 3rd. Shell Oil Company wants to move forward next summer with plans for exploratory drilling. Links to the revised supplemental draft are at our website, aprn.org. Information released today by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security indicates that Al-Qaeda last year considered hijacking and detonating oil tankers in non-Muslim seas to provoke an economic crisis in the West. The information comes from documents seized from Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. Speaking for the federal DHS, Matthew Chandler says there is no specific or imminent threat, although he said officials didn't know whether Al-Qaeda had continued the plotting since last year. Jeremy Zedek, a spokesman for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security, says the state always maintains a high level of monitoring critical infrastructure and said the information comes from the federal level, not the state. Chandler stressed that the information doesn't indicate the presence of an imminent threat. Intelligence gathered by American officials suggests the 2010 plans to target marine oil infrastructure were not fully formed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans get guidance from 13 grandmothers.
Mr. Elders used to say, follow your instincts, it'll guide you.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Two men face possible federal charges in an ongoing investigation of a shooting of a federally protected Pacific walrus near a state sanctuary near Togiak. From member station KDLG in Dillingham, Daisha Eaton has the story.
One walrus is dead and at least three are injured after two men reportedly went on a drunken shooting rampage at the Round Island State Game Sanctuary near the town of Togiak. Sergeant Brett Johnson, Wildlife Protection Officer with the Alaska State Troopers, responded to the incident.
On the evening of May 9th, the Dillingham Police Department received a phone call from a Fish and Game employee in Anchorage who was in satellite phone contact with Fish and Game employees out on Round Island within the Walrus Island State Game Sanctuary. And they reported that a skiff had approached the island with two males aboard, had come ashore and began, the persons in the boat had begun shooting at a couple of walrus that were on the beach.
Sergeant Johnson teamed up with U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials and headed to Togiak via aircraft to track the suspects down.
We were given a fairly good description of the suspects, and after arriving in Togiak, we were able to contact two gentlemen in a skiff that closely matched the description that we had been provided by the witnesses. Contacted the two gentlemen in Togiak as they came ashore, identified them. They were appeared to be under the influence of alcohol.
Those men, 47-year-old Jesse Anariak and 60 Arkanarkiak, both of Togiak, are accused of driving their skiff while intoxicated, then opening fire on the walruses. The Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act protects the hunting privileges of Alaska Natives, which the men are. But the legal Alaska Native walrus hunt takes place in the fall. Hunters must have permits and are limited to 20 walruses, and they're required to take the walrus meat for food. The men are accused of just taking the animal's highly valuable ivory tusks. Arkanarkiak was arraigned at the Dillingham court. He was charged with importation of alcohol into a community that prohibits alcohol, accessing a state game sanctuary without a permit, discharge of a firearm within a state game sanctuary without a permit, landing the skiff in the sanctuary without a permit, wanton waste of big game, and misconduct involving weapons in the fourth degree for having weapons while under the influence of alcohol. Arnariak was arraigned on May 10th. He's charged with the same offenses, but with a DUI and resisting arrest. Their next court date is set for July 26th at the Dillingham Court. The men are not in custody. All the charges are misdemeanors, but troopers say the men could face more serious charges stemming from the event.
The case and the investigation is still ongoing. The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service is conducting their own, I would say, separate investigation into the potential of federal charges. The witnesses who first notified us, the researchers on Round Island, did manage to take photographs and some video of the two suspects approaching the island, landing on the shore, and in the process of committing the violations. And we are reviewing them and using those as a part of the case.
The three injured walruses reportedly fled the scene of the shootings. No word on their condition. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is not commenting on the incident. The Pacific walrus is a federally protected species. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A group of scientists who study the Pribilof Islands are on their way to Seattle for a North Pacific Marine Science Conference. This isn't big news, since the Galapagos of the North is a hub for all kinds of interesting research. But these scientists are special because they live on the islands, and most of them haven't yet graduated from high school. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Eighth grader Anthony Lakanoff is a bit nervous for the presentation Monday morning, but he says he's been practicing the PowerPoint lots with his fellow students, and that's given him confidence.
We hope to all do pretty good, actually.
Anthony lives on St. George Island. He's traveling to Seattle with seven fellow students from St. George and St. Paul to speak at an international science conference called PISCES that focuses on the North Pacific. The students were invited by one of the conference organizers, who heard about the science projects they were working on. They'll talk about the ecology of the islands. Anthony says his part of the presentation will focus on king crab.
I learned that the population is going down by a huge number.
For the last 4 years, many of the students have attended marine science camps with biologists doing research on the islands. Tanya Cushion is a science teacher at the St. Paul School, and she'll travel with the students to the conference. She says the students have learned a lot from the scientists who visit the islands.
We live in a place that has an incredible backyard. Our resources are great, and the fact that we're lucky enough to have scientists who are willing to come and spend their time and teach us their expertise, I think that just is a great opportunity for the students here.
During the school year, Cushion says she tries to get the kids outside doing research as much as possible. Eighth grader Siofania Rukovishnikov says one of her favorite projects involved plankton.
It was fun because we got to throw some nets that would catch plankton. And it was really fun trying to identify them.
She says the plankton look like little bugs under the microscope. Teacher Cushion hopes the conference gives the students more confidence in the scientific work they're doing. And she enjoys seeing the enthusiasm her students show for science. But she says it's not just about convincing them to become marine biologists.
I think teaching sciences can really open their minds to really practicing logical thinking and gaining the skills, and you can take a lot of those skills into multiple fields.
Still, she does have at least one convert. When I ask Anthony if his studies make him excited about becoming a biologist when he grows up, he doesn't hesitate to give this answer.
Heck yeah, it does.
In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
While the names of the five clam diggers who died earlier this week in Cook Inlet have not been released, the president and CEO of Pacific Seafood Group said yesterday that three were from Oregon and two from California. Pacific Seafood Group is the parent company of Pacific Alaska Shellfish, where the five were contract employees. Frank Dulcich said he was withholding the names in respect for the family's privacy. He also said his company was setting up a memorial fund for the families. The men went missing Tuesday while traveling in a 20-foot skiff near Polly Creek. The bodies of all five were recovered. The cause of the accident is still under investigation.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Many economic indicators point to strong salmon markets this year, which could be good news for those who make their living netting sockeye each summer in Bristol Bay. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The 2011 sockeye salmon season in Bristol Bay is shaping up to be a good year, according to one of the leading fish economists in the country. Gunnar Knapp says there's quite a bit of optimism being expressed by seafood buyers, sellers, and processors about the wild salmon market this year, especially the sockeye salmon market.
I think the biggest factor is a steady growth in demand for wild sockeye salmon, in particular this sockeye salmon fillet product that has dramatically diversified away from what was a very strong dependence on the Japanese market.
The speculation this year is that prices paid to Bristol Bay fishermen will exceed those paid last year. Knapp says there are some other factors at play that could result in stronger markets this year.
One is that exchange rates are strong for the euro and the yen relative to the dollar. Another thing in the Japanese market is that due to this tragic tsunami they had, it actually destroyed a lot of product that was in cold storage, and furthermore, an expected shortfall in their domestic chum salmon production going into the fall because of the damage to the fish traps and processing facilities.
The Bristol Bay sockeye salmon run this year is forecasted to be about 38.5 million fish, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game notes that about 28.5 million fish could be available for commercial harvest. While Knapp says demand is up and efforts to produce quality products have apparently been successful, there's still one factor that could dramatically impact the salmon markets. That's the old bugaboo of farm salmon, especially farm salmon produced in Chile. However, Knapp notes that wild salmon producers have been doing a good job of differentiating their products from farm salmon products.
If people feel that wild Alaska sockeye salmon is what they want, not just any salmon, then it doesn't matter how much the Chileans produce, or it doesn't matter as much. It's not going to anytime soon flood the market and create a sort of real oversupply and depression in prices in the way that it did back in the early 2000s.
Gunnar Knapp is a professor of economics with the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research, and he's been studying world salmon markets since the early 90s. He's considered one of the foremost experts on Alaska's salmon industry. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Today, the MS Amsterdam made its first Anchorage appearance of the season with a morning docking and a day-long stay. It's the second year that the Holland America vessel has come to Anchorage and the first of eight calls scheduled for the summer on alternating Fridays. The Amsterdam carries just under 1,400 passengers and 600 crew members. It spends approximately 16 hours in Anchorage. Two other ships, Ocean's Regatta and the Silver Sea Silver Shadow, will also dock at Anchorage this summer. There's concern the Fairbanks Borough's ride service for the disabled may not be able to keep up with rising costs. VanTran is seeing 18% annual growth in demand, and last week the Assembly turned down measures including a fare hike aimed at supporting an alternate voucher program. Mayor Luke Hopkins told the Assembly vouchers for cab rides are a proven option for some users.
They're working in other communities, and we were going to try it in this community. Maybe we only get 5 vouchers, maybe we get 500 vouchers for people to use other systems.
VanTran users pay $2 for rides that cost the borough $76 each to provide. The $1.4 million a year program is required to meet federal Americans with Disability Act requirements, but Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller described vouchers to the Assembly as an alternative for more than half of VanTran users.
Obviously, individuals in wheelchairs are not going to be able to take advantage, but any of our current riders that can ride in a car or a taxi, which are probably the majority of them, will be able to use this.
Vantran users didn't like the idea of raising fares to support the voucher program, and the assembly turned down a proposal to allocate additional money to fund it. Miller said the bureau is preparing for a user eligibility audit to assess who really needs Vantran. Privatization of the program is another possible cost-cutting option. Anchorage and Juneau have contracted out their transportation services for the disabled and substantially lowered per-rider costs. Some members of Fairbanks' disabled community advocated for privatization at a recent assembly budget hearing. Ten residents of a Southeast Alaska Native village just completed training to be the only medical first responders in their community. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
Emergency health care in Klukwan just got even better. Four village residents just completed the week-long course to become registered emergency trauma technicians. The certification, also called ETT, is often used in rural parts of the state to control emergency situations until other help can arrive. And this kind of training hasn't been in Klukwan in quite some time.
About 20 years ago, I took an EMT course.
Just ask Kimberly Strong, president of Tilkat Indian Village. She's one of the four newly certified ETTs residing in Klukwan.
Because sometimes it takes the ambulance to half an hour to get out here. And, you know, everybody's so close with one another out here. Everybody knows each other, and it would be just a shame to be standing by while somebody ended up dying because none of us had any training to save their life. And so I think that's kind of why all of us took the ETT course.
Currently, the village located 22 miles from Haines has a small health clinic operated at minimal hours by SEARCH, or Southeast Regional Health Consortium. Doctors from town make biweekly visits, and in emergencies, the Klahini Valley Fire Department at Mosquito Lake or Haines Volunteer Fire Department are typically the trained volunteers called in to assist.
We're really lacking in staff. We have doctors that come out from Haines to Klukwan twice a week. And so, it could be hit or miss on having somebody here in the community at the time there's an emergency. So having some emergency folks available will be helpful.
The Haines Department operates ambulances and has a crew of volunteer first responders throughout the Chilkat Valley. They're trained to offer medical assistance and transport to the Haines SEARCH Clinic in emergencies. But SEARCH has recently acknowledged the importance of having more of a presence in Klukwan.
We started out with SEARCH administration coming to Klukwan and talking to us. And we have a need to have, also because we're starting the cultural center and cultural tours up here, we recognize there could possibly be an emergency situation where we could use extra help. Our health aide had resigned, and we haven't gotten a new medical provider that will be working here in the village yet. And so we definitely have a gap in our services. So we asked SEARCH about doing CPR and ETT course.
The idea to train first responders in Klukwan came from Don Hotch, Jr. He says it's a first step in forming a complete fire department in the village.
This is a very cool thing. It's pretty exciting to have, and likely just the first step. I'd like to be a little more ongoing as far as the crew goes. I'd really like to have a little more participation, looking for a little bit more of an integrated into the community type of thing. The more training, the better for the community in general. It's going to be for the support for the valley. It's going to be in the village. It's going to be, it's just a good thing for the community overall.
Hotch completed the ETT training along with Tom Stevens, Joanne Elsie Spud, and Kimberly Strong. There are also six residents who just completed CPR training.
It just gives us an opportunity to be prepared in an emergency. And we are just ETTs, we're not EMTs, and we're limited in scope of what we can do, but we can, perform CPR. We can make sure the ABCs are done, airway breathing and circulation.
Julie Anderson, paramedic and registered nurse in Haines, taught the Klukwan classes. She says the trained volunteers will help the Haines department because there will now be first responders in place to help stabilize a patient around a half hour before the ambulance can get there. She added first responders historically save lives in situations like near drownings, severe bleeding, choking, and more. In Klukwan, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Rita Blumenstein, a Yupik traditional healer, is being honored this week in Anchorage by women from around the world. She's part of the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, a group which seeks world peace and healing. The grandmothers travel to each other's homelands to help spread that peace. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
Blumenstein is 77 years old and now lives in Anchorage. Because the council is meeting in Alaska, she chose the theme, which is healing the spirit from the light within.
The problem today, we have too many things, too many tools, not accepting what comes to you, not following it. Because the elders used to say, follow your instincts, it'll guide you.
The 13 Indigenous Grandmothers Council holds prayer ceremonies, healings, and cultural exchange with the Indigenous people living in the area that they're visiting. The Anchorage Gathering is the ninth gathering for the council. They started meeting at the Dena'ina Center on Wednesday and will continue to meet through Saturday. They often have taken their ceremonies outdoors, and this week they gave a blessing to Anchorage's homeless. Blumenstein grew up in Nelson Island, but also attended a Montessori school in Seattle for 4 years. She says she knew she had the gift of healing at an early age.
When I was born, my mom knows and she trained me, though. The elders trained me.
She says she was guided by her great-grandmother to heal others, and the 13 Indigenous grandmothers is like a prophecy. When Blumenstein was 9 years old, her great-grandmother gave her 13 stones and 13 eagle plumes and told her she would be part of a council of 13. Her grandmother told her to save the precious relics for that time. And according to the group's website, Blumenstein passed the 13 stones and feathers to the members at their first gathering in 2004. Blumenstein and her healing process live in the moment. She lets her healing powers come to her, and she says she doesn't force anything.
It's just a gift. I have to accept it. And whatever comes to me, I use it. I don't question it. And when it's not there, I don't look for it. When it's ready, I don't say, no, I do it right now.
Blumenstein sees a lot of historical trauma with cultures across the world. She would like her own Yupik people to start the healing process and to learn to balance their traditional and modern roles. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Any Fight reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.